Hi, Dan.
Hey, Byron. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you today?
All right. It's, for once, not 90 degrees and really, really humid up here, so no complaints
there.
Well,
you know, I just noticed something. I mean, just this very second, I'm doing this in a different part of my house than I normally do it, and I think this will probably drive Bob right insane. I've just noticed there's a ceiling fan spinning around behind my head, so... But, you know, Washington is a sleepy southern town, and it is the last day of July, so here we are.
Maybe if we're lucky, we can get the tech people to shoot your side in black and white, so, you know, you have that nice sort of film noir
look.
Yeah,
it's a good old-fashioned, kind of a 40s blogging heads look.
That would be an awesome idea. I'd want to see that. You know, can you imagine? You'd have to have, like, that music in the background. We'd both have to be smoking.
Yeah. Just like they did blogging hits in the 40s. I mean, it would be...
I could do the Bogart. That would be awesome.
So
yeah.
Cool. Well, you know, here we are.
John McCain looked nervous.
We're giving these creative ideas away for free. You know, just think about that.
That's true.
Listen, the first topic for us today is something... that I actually put up on The Corner, which is our group blog at National Review Online. And it is the latest Gallup poll, which was sent to me this morning. And one question I thought was very, very interesting, which is it asked 1,000 adults, not registered voters or likely voters, but adults, how much confidence do you have in this or that presidential candidate to handle this or that specific issue? And I had numbers on three issues. The first was the war in Iraq. Second one was the general issue of terrorism. Third was the economy. And the fourth was health care. And the numbers I thought were actually quite interesting because it showed that Republicans still do have their strength on the issue of terrorism. But on the issue of handling the war in Iraq, Democrats are virtually even with them. The numbers were this. You were asked to say, do you have no confidence, a lot of confidence, a fair amount of confidence? So if you put together the people who said they had a great deal or a fair amount of confidence in a candidate, you get McCain, 55%. By the way, I think this is one indication that John McCain is not dead out there beyond the political consulting world, which assumes that he's, you know, he's just awaiting burial at the moment.
Although it could be an indication also that these weren't registered voters, but we'll go ahead with that.
Well, it's entirely possible, but they may vote. McCain, 55, Giuliani, 55, Obama, 54, Clinton, 51, Edwards, 50, Thompson, 39, and Romney, 37. Now, we actually need some nifty blogging heads graphics probably to put up to actually show viewers those numbers. But, you know, the interesting thing is you have McCain and Giuliani tied at the top. But you have Obama and Clinton pretty close.
Yeah, certainly probably within the margin of error,
that's,
I guess.
That's right. Different numbers, though, when they're asked about who is the best to handle the general issue of terrorism. There you have Giuliani.
Byron, just, you know, I'm going to do the graphic as you read the numbers.
Okay, you can write on a piece of paper and put it up.
Yes, exactly.
You have Giuliani with 69 and McCain with 66. And then you do have a gap between the next is Hillary Clinton at 55, Obama at 53, then Edwards, 48, Thompson, 42, Romney, after having spent a zillion dollars, is at the end again with 38%. And, you know, Giuliani does have this amazing strength on the issue of terrorism. And, you know, I don't think it's fully warranted just from his performance on September 11th, which was stellar. But was not, really a national security performance. But he has it, and, you know, this is an area, I think, where Republicans are extremely strong. The next one is on the economy. And here you have Obama and Clinton at the lead with 62 and 61%. But here again you have Giuliani up with them. I think it shows that Giuliani is the best balanced of the Republican candidates. He's at 60%. And then after that you have the rest of the pack, McCain, Edwards, Romney, and Thompson. And then finally is health care, which is where Democrats are just destroying the Republicans, to no one's surprise, I guess. Clinton, 65, legacy of Hillary Care, 65. Obama, 61. Edwards, 54. And then you have Giuliani at 52, McCain, 45, and the others lower down. So I think that there are several lessons from this. One, maybe McCain isn't completely dead. to Giuliani as the most balanced package among the Republicans. Three, Romney has spent tons of money and is doing well in Iowa and New Hampshire, but hasn't broken through nationally. And four, Thompson hadn't, you know, has spent almost nothing, done almost nothing compared to Romney, and he's pretty much in the same place.
I like that last point. I mean, look. Looking at the numbers, a couple things strike me. The first is, again, I have to wonder how engaged the public is, or at least the ones that were polled were, on this question. Because, I mean, the fact that Hillary did so well in the healthcare question,
right,
I find particularly interesting for two reasons. The first is, as you point out, this is an odd legacy for Hillary Care because,
right,
you know, certainly all Republicans vehemently opposed it. A fair number of Democrats were not particularly thrilled either with,
right,
the content of the proposal or certainly the process through which Hillary put it forward. And furthermore, correct me if I'm wrong, Hillary actually has not really been all out in front on health care this time around. I mean, Obama and Edwards have been much more vigorous in pushing health care on the Democratic side than Clinton has.
I agree with you. But one of the ways that she refers to health care very specifically and consistently in her virtually every stump speech or presentation I've seen her make, she'll say she's learned a lot about it and she has the scars to prove it. She makes a little humorous reference to her bad experience in 1993, 1994.
Right.
And so it could be, you know, I did a piece for USA Today a few weeks ago, and it was on this idea of executive experience. You know, voters like executives when they choose presidents.
Right.
I think everybody since John F. Kennedy has been either a governor or a vice president, right?
He was vice president.
Yeah. So, I mean, they like executive experience. There's no doubt about it. So the question for Democrats is, you have no executive experience at all on the Democratic side unless you count Dennis Kucinich's tenure as mayor of Cleveland.
Well, there's Bill Richardson.
But, I'm sorry, you have Richardson.
Richardson's
not in the top tier.
Yeah.
Excuse me, I was wrong about that, but not in the top tier.
Okay, yeah.
And unless you count Hillary Clinton's years in the White House. And she clearly does. You listen to her talk.
Oh, yeah.
She talks about what she learned in the White House and how, you know. And so this is, I think, one of these areas where she's able to say, look, I've actually done this. I've tried this. I learned. I know. I've seen it from both ends, by the way, now that I've been in the Senate. And, you know, I think it's an area that kind of paradoxically, given that she's widely... it's widely agreed that she screwed the issue up terribly in 93 and 94. This is Exhibit A of her having learned.
Hmm. Or at least saying that she's learned.
Yeah, that may be completely wrong.
I mean, this is always the big question, you know, and I had gotten to this actually with the last blogging essay, which was with Ed Kilgore, which is, to what extent are voters, you think, willing to acknowledge both Hillary and Giuliani? Because Giuliani, although he certainly has the 9/11 glow about him, you know, there are plenty of people who think of him as, you know, having a mixed track record, let's say,
right,
in terms of being mayor of New York. And the question about both of them, I think, is fascinating, which is, to what extent do you think they've changed from their 90s personas?
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple of things. You know, as I talk to Republicans, you know, Giuliani, for example, leads in the polls in,
yeah,
South Carolina, where a lot of political types have thought, oh, my goodness, social conservatives are so strong down there, he doesn't have a chance. They respect his record in New York a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly Giuliani, I think, is maybe the finest public executive, government executive of the last 20 years. And so they know what happened. They know, you know, that there were close to 2,000 murders on the year that he took office.
Right.
And, you know, 5 years later, there were 600.
Mm-hmm.
It was just an astonishing... I know what he did for welfare rolls, for the economy. So he gets a lot of respect.
Yeah.
Now, he has worked on changing some of the things that made him unpopular with New Yorkers, who nevertheless elected him and reelected him.
Right.
And that's the image. And I'll give you one small example. There's a great, I think it's on YouTube, you can see it. There's a great video of Giuliani's at some campaign appearance, and one of these 9/11 truthers walks up to him.
Oh, dear.
And she starts telling him how he knew that these buildings were going to fall,
mm-hmm,
in advance. And he knew about World Trade Center 7 and explosives and all of this stuff. Just, you know, the whole 9/11 truther thing. And this was a prime example for the Giuliani of old to tell her that she was totally full of it, She was absolutely crazy. She was wrong. She needs help, you know, to go all ferret on him, you know. And Giuliani just smiled and answered seriously, no, I did not. If you look at the record, there's this, that, and this. And then he moved on. So I think he's definitely tried to sand off some of those edges that made him less than popular, particularly in his later years. So, look, I think that
and it is worth, I mean, it's also worth pointing out, precisely, this is a YouTube campaign in some ways, in that
yeah.
You would expect that if Giuliani or if any candidate makes some sort of really dumb, off-the-cuff,
right.
you know, remark, it's going to show up in a YouTube, like when... didn't McCain sort of have that singing thing about bombing Iran?
Oh, bomb Iran, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And Giuliani has managed to do, you know, he's gone 8 months so far and hasn't had one of those moments yet, so...
Which is pretty good for him, I mean.
Yeah, for Giuliani. I mean, again, you're grading on a curve here, but still, you're right. He hasn't done that yet.
So the other thing is, this handling of the war thing, I mean, I think that the fact that McCain, Giuliani, Obama, and Clinton are tightly packed within 4 points of each other, just indicates basic divisions in the public opinion about what to do now. Wouldn't you say that?
It indicates, say that last part? It indicates
just
what?
Basic, it reflects the basic divisions between the two parties on what should be done now, it seems to me. The fact that both of them get pretty high, both pairs, Obama, Clinton, McCain, Giuliani, get pretty good ratings.
I think it actually might reflect the way the public thinks about war, which, you know, if you take a look at polling, yeah, and you can go back to Vietnam and you find similar numbers there, which is Americans generally are very uncomfortable with the idea of limited war, with the idea of prosecuting a campaign where you don't take the gloves off with sort of the goal of achieving either a stalemate or a sort of limited arrangement. They don't like limited war.
Or just winning.
What?
Or just winning.
Right. Well, no. The point is they either like winning or withdrawing.
Right.
The Americans are very clear. They don't like a sort of moderated strategy where you say you're going to use force, you're going to use force to advance a political goal, which is not, you know, complete unconditional surrender, but rather, you know, achieving a stable Iraq, for example,
right.
as opposed to a democratic Iraq.
Right.
So the problem is that, you know, my suspicion is that the public either sees in McCain and Giuliani people who, I don't know, will be thought of as taking the gloves off and, you know, pursuing full-throated victory, and then, you know, Clinton and Obama are perceived as the opposite of saying, look, we're going, you know, we're not going to win, so let's get out now.
Mm-hmm. Well,
that would be my interpretation.
Well, it's been my feeling that talking to Republicans,
mm-hmm.
I mean, there are a lot of Republicans who are very unhappy with George W. Bush right now
yeah.
over the war.
Yeah.
But they're not unhappy with Bush over the war for the same reasons that MoveOn.org is unhappy
right.
with Bush over the war.
They're unhappy because they think we're not winning, but not because they think we should get out, I assume.
Exactly, because we have not won.
Right.
And they also believe, and I think there's a fair amount of evidence to back them up, that Bush did not go in with the full force that he could have. And
no, he didn't.
That there were restrictive rules of engagement that in some ways tied the hands of American forces. I mean, this is very much a Vietnam kind of attitude.
Right. Although, have you seen No End in Sight yet, by the way?
No, I haven't.
I would recommend it. I recommend all Republicans mm-hmm. look at it, actually, because mm-hmm. the chilling thing about the movie is that, you know, 90% of the interviews are with people who served in the administration at one point
right,
or another.
Right.
So this is not like you've got, you know, Noam Chomsky out there raving about why this happened. It's primarily about how the occupation was screwed up by people who were actually inside on the process. It's a very mm-hmm. damning movie.
Mm-hmm. All right, I tell you what. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about on this poll, these poll results?
The only other thing I will mention, and again, it leads me to wonder either how much the poll matters or how much money matters. It strikes me as very interesting that Mitt Romney does so badly.
Yeah, right.
I mean, that's the thing that shocks me because, you know, by just about every other measure, Romney is considered, you know, not only a front runner, but a front runner who actually has momentum.
Yeah.
Whereas if you look at these polls, you'd think he's a second tier candidate. So the question mm-hmm. becomes, as the campaign proceeds, are the poll numbers going to change or is Romney's status going to change? My prediction is the poll numbers will change. Because, again, I think the fact that they didn't poll registered voters, but it was just adults, suggests to me that these numbers are pretty soft anyway. But we'll see.
Romney has been at the back of the pack.
What?
But Romney has been at the back of the Republican pack.
Yeah.
Or not the super back of the Republican pack, but he's certainly been the lowest of the top tier, I would say.
But in some ways, he's like Obama in that, I mean, both of them are winning the relative money races,
Well, I mean, first of all, yes, he's raised a lot of money, but you have to remember that he's put $9 million of his own dollars into the the thing. And at the time, a few weeks ago, when the McCain report came out and said he had $2 million cash at hand, Romney would have had $3 million cash on hand had it not been for the $9 million he wrote from his own bank account.
Right. Also, Romney's burn rate is actually pretty high.
His burn rate was 100% for that time. So and the other thing that you have to remember, Romney is doing a very focused Iowa and New Hampshire strategy. Hmm. He leads in most of the polls in both of those states, and he's working on the assumption that you can say what you want about the compressed schedule or the new schedule and bringing Florida and Super Duper Tuesday. You can say what you want about all those things, but if I'm the guy who wins Iowa and New Hampshire, I'm going to be hard to stop. You know, that is the strategy he's working on. And he spent, you know, when the last disclosure came out and we saw how much the candidates had spent on radio and TV ads, most of them hadn't spent anything on TV.
But Romney had,
had run thousands of ads in Iowa and New Hampshire. So more in Iowa where he's not known the way he is in New Hampshire.
Right.
But I think that his guess is that the poll numbers are going to change. But they may not change until very close to the Iowa-New Hampshire voting.
No, that's very true.
So we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see.
Now, the next topic is one I wanted you to kind of take the lead on, because Stanley Kurtz, who writes with me at National Review Online, has written a few posts in the corner about abolishing tenure.
A campaign to abolish
academic
tenure,
all of which is coming kind of as a hangover from the Ward Churchill affair. So I wonder what your thoughts about that were.
All right, let me preface this by making clear my following bias. I am a tenured professor, so I'm arguing out of self-interest here. I like tenure. Very glad I have it. People are arguing, well, he's just doing this because, you know, he's worried that they're going after him a job. Damn straight, that's why I'm worried. But that said, that doesn't mean I don't think my arguments lack merit. As you can figure out, Stanley is upset at the fact that the Ward Churchill process, in which Ward was actually fired, but Churchill was fired, but he was fired despite the fact that a fair number, I think close to 200 academics at the University of Colorado Boulder, signed a petition saying we don't think he should be fired, even though, you know, what Churchill did, what he was being investigated for, wasn't the comments that he made.
Exactly.
About...
Exactly. We should point that out. It wasn't the little
Eichmann
thing. It was actually plagiarism, right?
Yeah, it was rank plagiarism and fraud, basically. He wasn't being condemned for what he'd said about 9/11. He was being condemned because of the fact that he'd done poor research. After 2 years, the University of Colorado, the president of the school, fired him despite the protest by the academics. And I think Kurtz is reacting against the protest, saying, clearly, you know, we need to take action. What's the phrase? He wants to replace tenure with long-term contracts.
Right.
I'm looking at this right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little odd because he's got this sentence that really is actually quite chilling. Where he says, more than anything else, the conversion of tenure from a protector of academic freedom into an instrument of ideological exclusion is responsible for the destruction of the campus marketplace of ideas. Tenure is the cornerstone of the campus political correctness problem. And even beginning a serious effort to remove it would almost certainly shake up the entire academic system. The time to consider a serious campaign to eliminate academic tenure has come. What bothers me here is that Kurtz is basically suggesting that because of the political views of tenured academics, we should abolish tenure, which, of course, is actually kind of one of the reasons why tenure was, you know, initially created in the first place, which was to protect, you know, the freedom of academics to articulate what might be considered unpopular points of view. Mm-hmm. So that's problem one I got. Problem two I've got is the way in which he seems to be proposing doing this, which is he wants a sort of conservative state legislature to attack tenure, you know, presumably at a state school. Like, let's say, I think he proposes Texas. Or someone proposed, you know, Texas is one example.
Yeah, his suggestion is that the conservative state legislature does this, and when they even begin talking about it, then the professoriate will just go ape.
Yeah.
And then there'll be a big debate about it. So finally there'll be an actual debate about this issue.
There might be a debate about it, but I would say two things. First, I'm not sure the professoriate is going to go quite as ape as he suggests, because they're not stupid. They're not going to threaten their own feedlot if they, you know, wildly overreact. But even if they do, it would actually be completely against... I mean, the problem with this is, let's say you're a conservative state legislature, let's say you have the debate, and let's say it turns out that the professors are just as out there as Kurtz accuses them of being, although I would dispute that. But let's assume that's the case. If that happens and a state legislature abolishes tenure at a particular state, basically what this guarantees is that that state would then lose all of the best researchers at their university. Because right. all these people would then migrate elsewhere.
To places that still have tenure.
Exactly. And in fact, the people that would stay behind would be the people that wouldn't be able to find jobs elsewhere. And yeah, you might have, pay them less and presumably not have them tenure, but I'm not sure the education system benefits all, too much from this.
Yeah, now we should point out that, tenure is not in the Constitution.
No, I would hope not.
And universities are free to have it or not have it, right?
Right, exactly. So, I think,
so even if it were, quote, abolished, it's unlikely it would be abolished everywhere.
Right. I think the problem is that I think what Kurtz is supposedly, suggesting is that because a large number of schools have it, it's very difficult for an individual school to get rid of it, which is true. But there's a reason why there's an additional reason beyond that of academic freedom why tenure evolved, which is simply this is what the market, this is one of the ways the market, actually rewards people from going into academia. Relative to the salaries that people get in comparable professions elsewhere with the same amount of education, professors make much less than, right. Just about any other profession with the same amount of education. So the effect of abolishing tenure, I don't think, would be that you would, manage to get rid of the deadwood. It would be that you would actually be driving anyone who could get a productive job in a different field to go and leave academia.
All right. Well, let me ask you, and I'll certainly let Stanley speak for himself in any future debates, but, you would agree, that this is somebody who is not in academia, you would agree that there seems to be a fair amount of ideological consistency on some campuses, and it certainly seems that way to me. And the question to you is, what role, or does tenure play a role in that?
To the first point, I would actually, it's not so much that there's ideological uniformity, I don't think that's true. What I do think is true is that there is a large gap in terms of the political... There, frankly, just aren't a lot of conservatives in certain branches of the academy. That doesn't mean, therefore, that everyone else is uniform.
Why is that, do you think? Are they not as smart? Or
no, what? No, that's not true. That's been suggested by some. That's horseshit. No, I think it's true for a couple of reasons. The first is, again, this point of the presumably smart people who are going to become professors, that's not their only career path. So they might choose a different career path, one that might actually be more rewarding financially. And it would not shock me if conservatives followed the money a little more. That's possible reason one. Possible reason two, though, and I'm sympathetic to this argument, is that because campuses on the whole are a little further left than most of the rest of society, if you're going to be a conservative in the academy, you've got to be prepared for the fact that you're in the minority from day one. Mm-hmm. And, some people aren't necessarily comfortable with that.
Let's say there's this imbalance.
Okay, that's fair.
Political or ideological imbalance. And then, so the question, again, is does tenure play a role in that?
It's an interesting question. I guess you can argue it might in the sense of once you're tenured, you're obviously not leaving the field. And so therefore, it might reinforce the sort of political orientation of those within the academy. There's a separate question, of course, which is whether or not the political orientation matters. Do you really care if, for example, your math professor is a Democrat or a Republican?
Depends on what he's saying in the classroom, I guess.
Well, exactly. I might be a Republican, but this is where I will defend my academic brethren, which is, I would say 99% of most professors who walk into the classroom are not going to suddenly spout off what their political views are, mm-hmm. To the class, because most of them are professionals about this. You basically go in and your goal is to teach whatever your subject knowledge is. I teach political science, for Pete's sake, so you would think that, in particular what I'm doing, there might be a lot of mm-hmm. politically charged rhetoric. But, I can tell you, having, sat in others' classrooms and in my own, that's less likely to be the case, because even in political science, what you're often trying to teach your students is the way the world is, not the way the world should be. So that's partly what's going on. I'm suspicious of this effort that somehow, you know, getting rid of tenure therefore guarantees that you are somehow going to have this suddenly ideologically more diverse faculty. It strikes me that unless you're willing to pay a lot more money for professors, it's just going to generally, you know, degrade the entire quality of faculty across the board.
Now, does tenure ever sort of consciously or maybe semi-consciously come into your mind when you think about things you would say publicly or publish? Or
actually, the irony about this, I would argue, is that, and I think I'm speaking for a lot of people here, what tenure does is that it causes you to act in a more conservative, risk-averse way when you think about speaking publicly.
It would
period.
Seem just the opposite, wouldn't
what?
It? It would seem to be just the opposite, though, wouldn't it?
Why?
Because you can't be fired.
Oh, you mean once you have tenure? I thought you were talking about the behavior before you got it.
Oh, no, you know, you're right. You should talk about both
things. Because there's two different things. So, for example, prior to tenure, you know, for example, in political science, a lot of professors who might actually want to write for a larger audience, for example, for a public audience, are much more gun-shy about doing that. It doesn't matter the political position they adopt. They just don't want to have kind of any public profile because, you know, the norms within, you know, my profession is, you know, unless you publish in a peer-reviewed journal, it doesn't count for anything. Mm-hmm. So it generally causes, it actually, in some ways, I mean, this is an interesting argument, the prize of tenure actually causes people to be generally more silent than they would be, you know, in the public sphere.
It causes them to conform, and if you have an academy that's basically on the left, it causes them to conform with that, doesn't it?
I don't think conform is the right word. It's just so much, you know, it's more keep your head down. I think once you have tenure, I mean, in my case, yeah, I suddenly don't, I care much less about what, you know, there's no question, there's a liberating feeling in knowing that you can pretty much write whatever you want, and you're not worried that that there's going to be any blowback. But let's put it this way. Let's assume there is a ideologically cohesive group, which I don't think there is, but let's assume that assumption is, let's take that assumption as given. Mm-hmm. If you replace tenure with a series of long-term contracts, the same effect that I talked about pre-tenure is going to kick in there. Because people, you know, lower down in the hierarchy are going to be afraid that they don't want to annoy people higher up in the hierarchy. And therefore, they're going to keep their mouth shut, regardless. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure you're really going to gain all that much by abolishing tenure.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm not sure about this, I must say. Now, because Stanley quotes a thing that Max Boot wrote. I should say, Stanley advocates some long-term serious study of the effect of tenure, doing it in kind of a systematic way, what we were just talking about.
Yeah.
Seeing what its effects, I assume, before and after it's awarded are. And he specifically says you don't want to fight it, something like a fight like this on the basis of op-eds.
No, that would be bad on a whole variety of levels, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So,
well, I mean, this is the other thing. I mean, as a social scientist, my general reaction to Stanley's, you know, proposal is, you know, I hope this is more than a reaction to the Ward Churchill case, because if it isn't, then that's a pretty bad, you know, I mean, you can't point to one data point and then say, that's it, we should abolish tenure.
Right, right. Well, no, my feeling is just from some slight familiarity with this is no. It's generally a reaction to what's perceived on the right, I know, as a great amount of ideological conformity on the left in the academy.
But then, let me propose the following. If this is true, there are other institutions out there that have remarkable amounts of ideological conformity. The military would be one that would come to mind. Would Stanley therefore want to break open that institution as well and force, you know, more ideological diversity among the officer corps, for example? God knows they're the molders of young men just as much as the academy is.
Well, my just off the top of my head, my first guess is the military is an institution unlike all others because people actually take an oath to follow orders, and they follow the orders of the commander-in-chief. They even do that to the point of dying, and it's not like any other institution in our country. So I really wouldn't, I don't think I could see that in the same way as I see colleges and universities.
Okay, although, I mean, I would argue in some way, you're absolutely right about the oath, but they are similar in that they are both professions in which the members do take, I mean, they do take, you know, I don't want to say, you know, professors are certainly not going to be putting their lives on the line in teaching students, but we do take what we do seriously in the sense of, you know, what we, I mean, in the, I'm not articulating this well, in the sense of, we do try to, you know, teach with the idea that we want to present our students, you know, the best teachers are the ones who present their students with a whole variety of range of views on a particular issue without necessarily tipping their own hand as to what they prefer. Right. I mean, that's certainly how I go in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And that's how all professors, you know, that I
Now, by the way, after class and in other situations, do your students want to know what you really think about this?
Well, because I have the blog, in my case, and this is actually an interesting issue because it's been difficult at times. I have a, you know, because I have the blog, people usually, my students, if they want to, can pretty easily find out how I think about an issue. And every once in a while, someone will bring that up in a class. You know, I'll make an argument, let's say, for X, when I've been very clearly blogging against X for, you know, quite some time. And the professor, you know, the student will say, well, wait a minute, you've argued against this in the blog. And I'll say, well, hold on. Now, you know, there are these other counterarguments. And that was just a blog post. That doesn't necessarily count.
And that's just a blog.
That's just a blog, for Pete's sakes, you know? You can't take that seriously.
All right. Well, listen, on to the next subject, which is something that's been talked about an amazing amount in the last 24 hours, which is the op-ed published in the New York Times on Monday by Michael O'Hanlon and Ken Pollack,
right,
entitled A War We Just Might Win, in which they go back to, and these are two initial supporters of the war and very serious critics of the prosecution of the war. They go back to Baghdad. I think they said they spent 8 days there, I believe. And they report a significant progress in the surge and basically give the case for more optimism about the surge as we wait for General Petraeus' report in September. Now, this has set off a huge amount of talking. I know in National Review it's been cited a lot already as something that could change the conversation. Politico today had a fabulous headline called Bloggers Unleash Fury on Optimistic Op-Ed.
Yes.
Democrats are having to talk about this, especially. And so, anyway, it has brought up something I think that's really, really quite interesting, because there was a story pretty much at the same time in the Washington Post, .com. I'm not sure if it was actually in the paper. But anyway, they talked with James Clyburn, who's the Democratic whip in the House.
Right.
And he suggested that the report...
This could be a problem for them.
...would, quote, likely would split Democrats in the House and impede his party's efforts to press for a timetable to end the war. Of late, this is Dan Baltz and Chris Saliza writing, of late there have been signs that the commander of U.S. forces might be preparing something more generally positive than was previously thought. Clyburn said that would be, quote, a real big problem for us. And I think this, you know, shows where Democrats and some Republicans, but especially Democrats, are about the war. We have this situation where a lot of what Bush has done has been enormously frustrating. We're now in year 5 of this war, and yet there could be some progress now. And, you know, it would seem to me that the American national interest would be in favor of good progress happening in Iraq. And yet, if you have those good things happening, it's a problem for Democrats, meaning politically, I think. So, you know, this really indicates, I think most people had thought, including me, that you would see from Petraeus and Ryan Crocker, the ambassador, a very, very mixed bag in which each side would be able to make the case that it wanted to make out of it. But if it is more positive, Democrats could have a real problem.
I guess the first question is, to what extent do you think the op-ed, because the one thing that bothered me about the op-ed is they don't talk at all about the politics within Iraq.
Right.
You know, they say the situation on the ground is improving, but, you know, and that's great. Don't get me wrong. I mean, you know, it's always, it's good to hear that the changes in strategy are working.
Yeah.
the question is whether this, you know, will lead to, you know, constructive long-term changes.
Right. Well, we should point out that the whole point of the surge was to essentially buy time with a little more security for the political process to begin to work. So the whole point of the surge was that the kind of progress that O'Hanlon and Pollock talk about is the predicate for this hope for political progress.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the real question, and this is actually the question, I mean, I don't know if you said, George Packer has now started blogging for the New Yorker.
Right. He's written about this specific piece now.
What?
He's written something about this specific piece.
Right. It's not so much he's written, I mean, the thing that I thought that was, I don't think he doesn't throw cold water on it. What Packer's mostly doing is what my response is, which is, I just have questions. Where did they get their information on this? You know, who did they talk to? To what extent does, you know, to what extent can I trust them?
Right.
I mean, and this is a serious issue. I think you're right about this being a problem for Democrats, although part of the problem, and this is going to lead to a lot of irrationality about this op-ed, is that O'Hanlon and Pollock in particular push a lot of Democrats' buttons the wrong way, in part because of the positions they took on, you know, prior to and in the immediate months following the war.
Right.
I mean, you know, Pollock, you can argue just, you know, potentially that the war doesn't take place without Kent Pollock's book. Because Pollock provided a lot of political cover for a lot of Democrats to support, you know, President Bush in 2002. And I think there's going to, you know, there's a lot of blowback from that. And O'Hanlon made similar sorts of points. So, you know, part of this for the Democrats is you're right. I mean, if the war in Iraq presumably, you know, is perceived to, you know, be improving, that'll obviously be a problem for Democrats. The other problem, though, is that they don't like O'Hanlon and Pollock for a whole variety of reasons.
Well, look, I think the idea that this is a conversation-changing op-ed is a little overblown.
Yes.
On the other hand, I think that the story in the Post is more serious, which is that which hinges on what Petraeus is going to say and what Crocker is going to say. And those people, we're going to have to assume, have more basis to, you know, on which to speak than O'Hanlon and Pollock do. So, you know, the question is, which way are they going to tilt this? Are they going to tilt it in the positive direction or, you know, the negative direction? And I think, you know, I think it's looking more and more to me like Bush will be able to basically continue what he's doing into 2008 and basically until the next president comes. So that the election will basically be a referendum on how to do this, you know, how to get out.
I guess, I mean, my skepticism on the O'Hanlon and Pollock thing, I think, is born of a truly weary frustration with how many times in the last 5 years have we seen a report or an op, you know, something like that, some kind of event where we thought, okay, now we've turned the corner?
No, that's true. That's true with every election or with the capturing of Saddam or with the execution of Saddam. You're right. There have been a zillion turning points that weren't turning points.
Now, you're right. I mean, you know, the problem is that can lead you to the reverse caution, which is, well, maybe we actually have reached a real turning point, but we're so jaded that we wouldn't believe it.
That's right.
You know, I think that's the conservative position at this point. Frankly, I think the turning point, the more promising turning point, is the fact that Iraq won the soccer game. What's the – I can't remember the name of the tournament they won. But they defeated Saudi Arabia for the Asia Cup, I believe, which was a big, big, you know, success in Iraq. And that's always nice, well, good feeling. But that said, I guess my question is, given the fact that, you know, the turning a corner language is being used time and time and again, do you think that there is anything that Petraeus can actually say and Crocker can say in September that would actually genuinely change the minds of people that, okay, we should stay there?
Minds of those members of Congress or minds of the public or what?
Both.
I think at this point, for a significant portion of them, that's unlikely.
Right.
Because I think the way Bush has handled this has put a serious burden on people who want to support the war.
Right.
Which is we're now in year five. And you could say that opportunities for progress were wasted in year two, 3 and 4 of this, and it was only after he lost the legislature in November of 2006 that he comes up with this new and better idea, and it could just be too darn late for real progress to be made. On the other hand, so a lot of people, and not just Democrats, are angry at Bush about that. On the other hand, you have to, I think, try, and everyone has to try to calculate what would be best for the American national interest. So just being mad at Bush and saying it's just too damn late, sorry if your surge works or doesn't work, we're out of there. That may not be the most mature way to go about this. So it's a huge dilemma, and it's something that a lot of people, myself included, are looking to see what Petraeus says and measure that, you know, against our own instincts. I mean, we all have instincts now, looking at Maliki and looking at the government, looking at what we've seen about how Sunnis and Shiites get along in Iraq for the past several years. We all have our own instincts about whether real progress or lasting progress is really possible. So we'll have to measure all that against what Petraeus said, which is why they've created this kind of enormous high noon for September.
All right, let me ask you a question. I mean, you pointed out that, you know, assuming that the report goes well, Bush can presumably, and the fact is, because he's, you know, still the president and, you know, running the executive branch the way he is,
yes, that counts.
Yeah, you know, he's going to largely be able to influence policy until 2008. Right. Here's my question for you, because you're more, you know, plugged into the GOP than me, I am. Once it becomes clear who the Republican nominee is, to what extent will that nominee actually have any influence over Iraq policy during, you know, from like the spring of 2008 on?
Yeah, I think the answer will be zero. The thing that interests me and that I've been waiting to see is how the candidates will begin to distance themselves from the policy.
Right.
But right now what's happened is the surge has put everybody on hold because Republicans quite rightly want to give it a chance to work. You know, they don't want to be in a situation like Harry Reid was when, I believe it was it last month, on the very day that the final unit in the surge had actually arrived in Iraq, Reid and Pelosi write a letter to the White House saying the surge, flatly, that the surge has failed. No Republican candidate, of course, wants to get involved in anything like that. But as we get into December, January, we may see Republican candidates begin to distance themselves. And the way they do it, I think, is they have to remain respectful of Bush. I mean, Bush bashing is not going to work anywhere in any Republican primary.
Right, but post-primary might work a little bit.
No, it really doesn't. I mean, you talk to people in South Carolina, for example, a lot of them are very unhappy about the war, and the reason they're unhappy is we haven't won it, and they blame Bush for that. But, you know, they want a respectful treatment of the president. They absolutely do. But they're very open to talk about a new direction and talking about a post-Bush world, including on Iraq. So I think that you will see some of that peeling away from some of the Republican candidates if things don't go terribly well in Iraq. I think you'll see that peeling away. To get back to your question, I don't think that'll have any real influence on what Bush does. I mean, Democratic majorities in the House and the Senate are not particularly going to change it. So I don't think a Republican candidate would change it.
No, that makes sense. I mean, there's an interesting LA Times piece over the weekend by Doyle McManus. And this ties actually back into your first point about the poll evidence that shows, my suspicion is the Republican, you know, the GOP is just going to focus. They're going to focus less on Iraq and much more on the war on terror, in part because Democrats are reluctant to talk about the war on terror because it's tougher. It's a tougher issue for them. Iraq is easy, you know, politically, let's face it. I mean,
well, just look at the poll we started out with. I mean, Republicans are strong.
Right. Because it's tougher for Democrats to walk the line on war on terror because it's much easier for them to sort of, you know, bash Bush on the Iraq strategy. But if you talk about the war on terror, then they actually have to start, you know, advocating more positive measures, and it's not clear their base is going to be thrilled with that either. In the same way that the Republican base is not thrilled to hear, you know, would not be thrilled to hear Bush bashing. So, it'll be interesting going forward to see whether or not developments on the ground actually do change the contours of the debate.
Yeah, but as far as the O'Hanlon Pollock thing, it's made an impression But what really matters, of course, is the Petraeus.
Yep.
Now, finally, our last topic today concerns YouTube, which we've mentioned once or twice already in this. And the story being that Republican presidential candidates are reluctant to be involved in the kind of YouTube debate that we saw in Charleston on Monday with
which you were at,
which I
right?
attended. By the way, I did go, and you know, it's funny. The it was held at the Citadel, and so we went to a few reporters went to a lunch the day of the debate with these two guys, Hurley and Chen, who had started YouTube, and they, I mean, they were happy.
Yeah, sure.
Guys. I mean, it, you know, they started this company in October. Excuse me, January of 05,
yeah.
I believe. And in October of 06, they sell it for $1.65 billion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they just exude happiness.
Yes.
But on the other hand, they have these new corporate masters at Google. Google, of all things, is the sort of buttoned-up corporation
mm-hmm.
here. And I think the Google people were interested in making sure that the YouTube guys didn't say anything, you know, crazy about politics, which they didn't do, and my feeling was they probably wouldn't do. I mean, I got the impression that these guys were really, really into video and technical stuff, and they really were extremely proud of having created this platform, this open platform for video that YouTube has turned out to be so enormously successful at. But anyway, you go to the Citadel, and the press and everybody is in Mark Clark Hall, which has all the pictures of all the former heads of the Citadel and all sorts of distinguished alumni. And you go in a room, and there's a pool table, and some of this kind of 60s swinging London lollipop-colored furniture, you know, that has been moved in, along with things like beanbag chairs. And you're thinking, man, this is not Citadel. What's going on? And then you go to the spin room where the, you know, a lot of the surrogates and some of the candidates come after the debate, and they've set up this other area with these beanbag chairs and stuff. And as it turns out, that was the Google people, you know, sort of making us all feel at home in the Citadel. And, you know, and there's a, you know, there's an F4 that sits out on the lawn in front of Mark Clark Hall, and a couple of, you know, giant artillery pieces, and, you know, the Citadel is the mm-hmm. Citadel. But anyway, so they have this debate, and there's some debate about whether it was really all that groundbreaking or revolutionary. To me, it seemed mostly like what we've seen in town halls, except people were speaking via video as opposed to actually being
right.
live. but the question is now, you know, Republicans don't want to do it. Mitt Romney says doesn't want to do it. He said something like, you know, there are more important things in politics than, you know, being answering questions addressed by a snowman. And Giuliani said that he had a scheduling conflict for this debate that was going to be September 17th in Florida. So now, correct me if I'm wrong, I think there's talk about moving it later to see if Republicans might agree to do it. My position is that they probably ought to do it.
I would say two things. First, also, the other contrast here is that the Democrats are all going to Yearly Coast, which is the sort of the second version of this convention that the Daily Coast site put together, which is basically, you know, sort of an agglomeration of what has been labeled the Netroots in terms of the left, you know, sort of collection of bloggers and other online activists, and that Democrats are certainly willing, you know, that the Democratic leaders are trying to, the candidates are trying to cater to, where, again, you wouldn't see a similar sort of thing happening on the GOP side.
Right.
You know, my instinct says that if they're averse to a YouTube debate where at least CNN presumably has edited, you know, and chosen which of these videos to show, they're not really prepared for the general election then, because...
Well, a couple of things. One, I should say, I was at Yearly Coast last year in Las Vegas.
Right.
I'm working on what I hope is a big story for the next National Review, and I'm not going to be going this year. I was basically very well treated last year, so I want to tell everybody I'm sorry I can't be with you in Chicago. But, I'm sure they'll miss me Terrible.
They will. You know that. But I'm sure they might have like a dummy in your honor.
But anyway, on the YouTube thing,
yeah.
It seems to me, you know, if I had to characterize the questions, I haven't gone over them specifically, but my impression from the ones in Charleston is the ones that were challenging to the Democrats were usually challenging from the left.
Right.
You know, why aren't they doing more on health care? Why aren't they getting out of the war faster?
Yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff. And would are the CNN Google people going to have a lot of questions that challenge the Republicans from the right?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know, because one thing we were during this lunch I told you about with the Google guys. I mean, they said that they were really adamant to point out that people who watch YouTube are all across the demographic spectrum.
Hmm.
But on the other hand, the people who actually upload videos onto YouTube are overwhelmingly young.
Yeah.
So you know, are we going to get a lot of questions from young right wingers who are unhappy that Giuliani hasn't signed on to a fair tax pledge or, you know, something like that. Maybe we will, maybe we won't. My feeling is that Republicans have, you know, they had their first or second debate was moderated by Chris Matthews, mm-hmm. who's been, you know, extremely critical of Republicans
yep.
in the past few years. And I don't think they want to get in a position of the Democrats and Fox News. So I think if have been kind of disgraceful in, you know, using Fox as a, you know, rallying point for their Daily Coast crowd. And so I guess boycotting all debates that Fox has anything to do with. So I would kind of turn around what you said. If they can't deal with Fox News, you know,
they're going to be in big trouble come the general. No, that's
yeah,
a fair
so
point.
I absolutely feel that even if these questions come at them from the left, or maybe that'd be a good thing, actually, for a YouTube debate, Republicans should show up for it because I think they can easily handle it.
Well, as you said, I mean, I think the most revealing. I have two thoughts on the phenomenon. First of all, have any of the people who pose questions, then you know, have they then posted YouTube responses to what the candidate said? I'm kind of curious about that.
You know, they must have, but I have to confess, I don't know.
See, this is it strikes me as interesting because presumably the part of the whole attraction of YouTube is that you can also, you know, post responses to these videos.
Right.
And it would strike me, I'm surprised that none of the people who asked the questions in the first place had not, you know, come back with, well, gee, I thought, you know, Biden's answer was dismissive, but I thought Obama's mm-hmm. answer was really good. Because actually that would be kind of interesting to see.
Well, we should point out that I believe there were two questioners that CNN had actually brought in.
Oh, okay.
To the debate with varying degrees of effectiveness. One, it worked well the first time, which was questioner, asked question via video.
Mm-hmm.
Candidate answers, and then Anderson Cooper says, well, you know, we have Mr. Smith with us right here in the audience.
Oh, okay.
And we'd like to ask him whether you feel your question has really been answered.
Mm-hmm.
And the first guy got up and said, well, you know, I got distracted. I didn't quite hear what they said, which was, you know, live television. But the other one was, I'm trying to think, I think the other one may have been the guy who asked the famous Iran, Syria, North Korea, Cuba, Venezuela question.
Right.
You know, I agree with you. I think the follow-up is probably good, and they should probably do more of that. But the more you do of that, by the way, the more you're making it like a town hall.
Yeah, that's true.
And so the
well,
the
I didn't mean so much follow-up at the debate, but rather that the people who ask the questions could then post their own video follow-up on YouTube. Now, and clearly this hasn't happened because I haven't seen a lot of links to it, but there's been no sort of bubbling up from YouTube response to the YouTube debate, which, you know, in and of itself is, I suppose, kind of disappointing and suggests that maybe the phenomenon is overblown.
Yeah, so I kind of agree with you. I kind of think it's gimmicky. I don't think it's the complete wave of the future. On the other hand, I do think, given that I think the Democrats look bad with their Fox News thing, I think that the Republicans should kind of take all comers on this and should be part of it.
I think it's good advice. So, anyway, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, the person who actually came off, the candidate who came off badly on this in part was also Biden, because didn't Biden just sort of dismiss one of the questioners, the one on gun control, as kind of a complete kook?
Well, he did. He went too far.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's my point.
The gun guy had said something, you know, are you going to take away my baby because this is my baby? And he shows this rifle.
Right.
And Biden says something like, hey, man, if that's your baby, you got problems.
Yeah.
You need help. And that got a very good response in the audience.
Mm.
But then he went on and on about it. You know, couldn't stop talking. So it should have been
Joe Biden couldn't stop talking.
One-liner.
Wow.
On the other hand, you know, that would be a pretty popular answer. I mean, the guy looked like a kind of, he loved his assault weapon or something. That would have been a pretty popular answer in the crowd, in both the Democratic crowd and probably the Netroots crowd as well. So he just pushed it too far, although Biden generally did a pretty good job. He's been actually pretty good in his questions on foreign policy in these debates.
I guess my conviction is that what would happen if the Republicans do this YouTube thing is that there will be some question that is somehow seen as out there, and, you know, it wouldn't shock me if a candidate comes off as too dismissive.
Well, he could, but as I mentioned earlier with Rudy in the 9/11 truth,
no, that's a fair point.
Been working hard to, you know, not show his get out of my face side. So this could be the ultimate test. All right. Well, listen, I think
I think that about wraps it up.
That covers our list of topics for today. And so I think we should wrap this up and hope to see you again on